Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is Tuesday, June 16th, 2020. And tonight we are saying the institutions in charge of the money supply are too greedy and too frightened to solve the problem of economic instability without COVID-19. And as you know, this is a news analysis. It's an anatomy of oppression, which always requires an anatomy of colonialism and imperialism, which is an anatomy of the American capitalist system. And before I turn the mic over to Brother Ralph and start our usual program, we have to say tonight, Delbert Africa, rest in power. On the move, moves Minister of Defense and former political prisoner, Delbert Africa, passed on Monday night, June 15th, at home, surrounded by his move family. This past January, Brother Delbert was released after 42 years of imprisonment. Imprisonment never broke his revolutionary spirit. May his revolutionary spirit live on in us as we continue the fight against the racist, oppressive, and corrupt system. We love and miss you, Brother Delbert. rest in power. This from the campaign to bring Mamiya home. And as many of you know, we have had an opportunity to have Brother Delbert on our program. And at some point in the program, we will, or maybe we'll start off with it. We may not finish with it, but we'll start off and let you hear a little bit of Brother Delbert when he first got out.
On the move. On the move to everybody out there that's being on the move, no matter what ideology, what thought, what process you're going under, if you're actively going up against this system, then you are truly on the move. My name's Delbert Africa from the Move Organization. I just want to say the Move Organization is a family of strong, serious, deeply committed revolutionaries founded by a wise, perceptive, strategically minded black man named John Africa. John Africa took each and every Move member from the weak body, sick, inactive, apathetic persons that we were and molded us into strong revolutionaries that are committed to doing away, eliminating this system, not reforming it, not changing its government, but eliminating this whole oppressive system. And what I'm here today, thanks to Noel Hamilton and Prison Radio, is a call for everybody else out there, I don't care who you are, to become and stay revolutionaries. Because revolution is not a philosophy, it ain't a theory, it's an activity. If you still worshiping money, if you still doing drugs, if you abusing your mate, then you ain't revolting against this system. You helping this system keep this same thing going. And what I'm saying is, I want the Echo Warriors to keep on fighting. I want Black Lives Matter to keep on revolting. I want the Animal Liberationists to keep on fighting. Those who are defending the native lands out there in South Dakota against that oppressive pipeline, keep on fighting. Don't let this system put you down. I want everybody in the LGBTQ community, keep on fighting. Don't give in. This is what John Africa has taught Move, not to ever give in to this oppressive system. It don't matter about jail. It don't matter about prison. We know that we can keep on and we won't be stopped. John Africa has taught us that Move can be hurt. All right, we all know people out there are being hurt by this system, but Move will not be stopped. We got feelings, just like all life got feelings, and we're sensitive, and we know we can be hurt, but Move will not be stopped. And we want everybody out there that's on that active path, that's about changing this system, to know that is revolutionary path, and you keep on with it, you won't be stopped. We want people out there to understand revolution is not a philosophy, it's an activity that everybody got to engage in. No matter if this system be crashing and shooting us down and jailing us, keep on fighting. John Africa has taught Move that revolution ain't a principle that is applied just when the oppressor is oppressing us. Revolution is the principle of freedom even when the oppressor don't exist. That means you got to be revoluting at home, on the street, in the courtrooms, and ever. Speaking of courtrooms, I want to emphasize and praise Black Lives Matter that, look, I love what y'all doing out there, young folks. Keep on doing it. But don't forget, this damn system be shooting us down, not only in the streets, but in them courtrooms. So get on them in them courtrooms. Get on them lying politicians that keep them courtrooms going. And for all those who have chosen to be and label themselves revolutionaries, don't never let it stop. If by chance you get elected to be a councilman or councilwoman, that don't mean nothing. Still take your revolutionary values straight there into the council chambers. If you become a judge, be a revolutionary judge. You know what I'm saying? This is what John Africa taught us, that revolution is the heart of life. Revolution is a principle of life that means you don't never stop doing it. You don't never give up. You just keep on doing it. And this is my message that I'm giving to you from the prisons of this damn system here. And I'm saying, keep on fighting for the freedom of all us political prisoners. Matula Shakur, Zola Azania, David Gilbert, Leonard Peltier, Sundiata Okoli, Jaleel Mutakwin, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and definitely all of the Move 9. And my sisters out there at Cambridge Springs, I love all y'all. And that's my message. And thanks again to Noel Hanrahan and Prison Radio for giving me this opportunity. On the move. Keep on moving, everybody.
Without further ado, Brother Ralph Pointer, what's happening?
Thank you so much for that, Sister Betty. What can we say after that? Delbert Africa, the fiery disciple of John Africa, when in the presence of all of the Africas, we feel joy, pride, and are receptive to learning. For those less receptive, Delbert was fiery and warm as well, and forceful in delivering his message of, you heard it, never give in, never give up. John Africa Presente has difficult to follow that, but we must move on. And I begin with what I believe. The overriding element in every circumstance or situation in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, move lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. Now, on the program, I also said I'm going to take a moment to dissect what I had said last week because it is piling up. We want to give all of our people a little summer vacation, but so many things are happening, it's hard to determine when we're going to do that. And the mainstays of the program, we will have a conference sometime in the next week, and we will decide what our schedule will be. But before I begin, let us continue our usual schedule. And that is to start with poetry. And we have our young poet out of Rochester, New York, Sarah Adams, daughter of Mary Adams and Ricardo Adams. And so, without further ado, Mary Sarah, your microphone is open.
Racist America. Systematic racism, the cause. Minority students missing out, the effect. Being born black means being born wrong. Being born black means that you don't matter. It's a setup, continuously going through the exact same thing. As we try to shine, we are shown no acknowledgement. But when we do finally shine, it's no big deal because, you know, the white's already been there and they already done that. As I see my fellow peers who don't look much like me get into an event that I was told I had to leave, this is an example of the crooked world that we live in. 3 miles up the road, they're getting money for enhancements, while we're stuck making cuts leading to a lack of an advancement. They say to drop the guns, but then they bring them in our schools. Please tell me how that adds up, because right now I'm confused. When you take profiling and weapons, it doesn't end up good, because now all of a sudden you want to shoot me because I'm your image of the hood. How is it that a headband can be dress coded? And furthermore, how is it that a dress code can affect my education? I don't get it. Now, is it school or is it prison? Because your precautions are very extended. No, I don't have a weapon, and I already turned my phone in. Sorry, I forgot to remove my jewelry, but why are you being so forceful? This is how students feel before they even reach their classroom. So how can you expect for us to thrive with no emotion? I want to learn my history. And I mean for real. I don't want to just learn that Rosa Parks sat in the front of the bus or that Frederick Douglass helped bring an end to slavery, which is back now, by the way, in a different form called incarceration. I want to learn about more than the same five African Americans, because we are more than that. But you disregard and you glorify your white progression that's rooted in oppression, leaving us in a depression that hasn't brought us anywhere but here. Sarah Adams, that's my name. Does it ring a bell? What about this? 890-217-928. You need to know that I'm more than that number. And my peers, I'm more than their number. You'll know that soon, though. I promise you that. You don't care about how we are. You just care about how the results look. And let's face it, they're not as good as you want them. Why, you ask? Because learning takes more than a worksheet and a pencil. Learning takes engagement. Learning takes time. Learning takes dedication. Learning takes belief. Learning takes communication. All of which our district has nowhere near enough of. Whose fault is this, you ask? Some say it's the district. Some say it's the governor and the state. Some say it's the teachers union, but to tell you the truth, it's all of the above. 86 million, we ain't leaving. Yep, that was us in Albany. Now, give us our foundation aid, and you'll see there were more than kids from gangs. We are the future. Thank you.
Okie dokie. You are the future. And with you and students like you in our future, we can struggle with greater hope. Thank you so much for that, Sarah Adams. And thank you, Mary and Ricardo, for raising such a wonderful, may she continue. But
we look forward to hearing you and your poems next week. Thank you so much.
As we started the program, the institutions in charge of the money supply are too greedy and too frightened to solve the problem of economic stability without the addition of the problem of COVID-19. And what I mean when I say that, in brief, we saw it two times recently. The government gave corporations and banks large amounts of money to kickstart the economy after they robbed the economy of the housing loans, subprime loans, which was nothing but a criminal document. But they got money to solve it, and what did the banks do? They laid off people. They gave CEOs large payoffs, and they continued stalling the economy, because if the money doesn't go into the economy, the money doesn't flow. This time, out of COVID-19, they gave the hospitals, et cetera, and the corporate institutions that were dealing with medical care large amounts of money. What did they do? They stole it. They put it in their pockets. They gave CEOs big payouts, and they did not allow the money to be paid to people who were working in the health industry. They laid them on, further hindering the stimulation, supposed stimulation of the economy. Greed, fear of being poor like the rest of us, causes them to be unable to solve our problem, and therefore we must solve our problem ourselves. And I want to get into one of the things, this one issue that we must talk about over and over again. It is not the police. They do not serve and protect. What they do is the army of occupation in our community is to silence and pacify. And when we talk about what has happened throughout our history, when we were denied the right to join a union, who defended that? The army of occupation. When we were denied the right to go to schools, who defended that? The Army of Occupation. When we were denied the right to sit at the bus in a certain place, who denied us? The Army of Occupation. And I could go on all night long. Therefore, their job is to protect the laws, corrupt laws, racist laws in our country, racist activities, hidden activities. Racism is practiced in a different manner today than it was 50 years, but it's still racism. And when you buck that, they bring the Army of Occupation. And I don't understand how we could have suddenly the question of the community control of the police when that is an oxymoron, the Army of Occupation. And we tried for 50 years to make people understand the wealth of the education industrial complex. Wealth. This is the way communities get wealth. And the Democratic Party, which is the major party in all inner cities in this country, keeps that wealth from us. And we must make people understand we must control our education money. In the city of New York, the education budget yearly is $30 billion. Imagine if we could join unions and get some of that money. Imagine if we could be the major teacher supply in those communities of color. We would have money. If we could get contracts to build, maintain, and run the schools, it would end this ridiculous, lopsided number of the unemployed in communities of color. It would end this ridiculous situation where the students did not know, as Sarah Adams said, you know, it's more than five people. If the students would know the names of all of our political prisoners and why they are in prison, this is what we must do, and we must understand it is an Army of Occupation that is, I want to say that it's not as vicious as it was 3 months ago, but that is not true. If we look at the facts, we're still being lynched in California. We see several lynchings. We see in Florida lynchings across the country, the killings across the country. But the difference is the cell phone photographs and social media. It's all the same. The Army of Occupation is holding us down. Let's get our program straight. Let's know where we're going, because they built such a large budget for the Army of Occupation called the police. They can give a little bit back and continue. They can send some of the armored vehicles back to the National Guard and continue business as usual, and they will just try to do it more quietly. So we must continue to understand what are the issues. The issues are control of a budget that will allow us to live and to educate ourselves. Without further ado, I pass the mic over to Sister Betty. Sister Betty.
Thank you, Brother Ralph, for that beginning discussion on what we mean by community control of your institutions. Part of the reason people do not know how to control their institutions is that there is no institutional memory in this country. Nobody tells the truth about how they got their jobs in this country. Nobody tells the truth about the infrastructure behind the procedures. But when it comes to the school system, because that is based on the black congressional caucus of the first black congressional caucus that brought it into being, there are laws, there are codes that give you democracy in education, and that does not exist in the institutions of the police because the police were slave catchers, and they have continued that role. And finally, everybody is admitting it. And there's no codification for citizens to control the police. So start with the easy one. Community control of education is the easy one. You're going to deal with an army of occupation. You need to consult the Vietnamese. You need to consult the Cubans. You need to consult the Russians. You need to consult all the people who are fighting for their freedom by any means necessary. But if you're dealing with education and controlling those institutions, if you're dealing with health and controlling those institutions, there is legislation to support your rights with this. A review board, a civilian review board, doesn't work, just like the Black Congressional Caucus of today doesn't work. They voted for the crack cocaine legislation. The Black Congressional Caucus voted for that. They voted to consider protesting and being arrested by a cop, a hate crime against the police, when they beat you over the head. So it's flawed, and they know it's flawed, and they plan ahead. Everything they give you, they've already planned how they're going to take it back. Only there are certain laws that are on the books that they have not taken back, and it's up to you to take advantage of them and control your institution. Education is an easy one. The majority of our children are still in the public school system. How are you going to give your children over to the enemy? It's about time you took the schools back. And stop blaming the kids for not doing the right thing if you haven't fought for them to have institutions that fight against metaphysical imperialism. And that's what education does. Without further ado, we're going to go back to Sister Ann Lamb of Jericho, who's going to continue the program in view of our loss with Africa. Sister Ann Lamb of Jericho, your mic is open.
Thank you so much, Sister Betty, Brother Ralph. Always an honor and a privilege to be with you, as we were on Sunday. I also have a very short statement from the MOVE organization. This was from their press conference today, and I wanted to read it because then what follows will show that it's absolutely true. Delbert Africa passed away last night, June 15, 2020. He was at home with his family around him. We want everybody to know that Delbert was another example of George Floyd. He was deliberately killed, methodically and calculatedly assassinated by the officials in Dallas prison as part of the government's plan to get rid of all MOVE men they could get their hands on. We know what Del was going through and why he was suffering. It's all of the horrific things they did to him, and the doctors out here in these hospitals said the prison did a lot of wrong things to Delbert, and they couldn't even understand why they did that stuff to him. But MOVE knows, and the people know why. It's prison official murder, the same as was done to Phil Africa and Merle Africa, the same as being done right now to a host of Black men and women all over America. MOVE, long live John Africa forever. And I say that this is true, and we know that this is true. Right now, our brother Kamal Siddiqui, who we just had his two daughters speaking with us on Saturday in our Zoom event, which you can watch on Facebook, is now in an outside hospital having possible vascular surgery on his leg. Now, this has been going on for a long time, another case of deliberate medical attempted murder. He was in an outside hospital previously. He was given, you know, massive amounts of antibiotics. When he got back to the prison, they just stopped giving him the antibiotics that they were supposed to be giving him. So, of course, this deep infection has never completely healed. So I don't have any more information right now except that he was taken to an outside hospital. So please, as soon as we have more information, we'll put it out there. But, you know, this is exactly what the MOVE people are saying is absolutely true. I am sure that if Robert Seth Hayes had not been given deliberate medical malpractice for more than 20 years, he would still be with us today. The same could be said to Delbert. He would still be with us today if they hadn't been so mightily trying to kill him. The same can be said for Herman Wallace, who was finally released and only lived 72 hours, an innocent man who spent more than 40 years in solitary confinement in Angola prison. And they knew he was dying, and they did not want to release him. The judge said, I will sit here and I will hold you in contempt. I will not leave my office until I know the man has been released. So, you know, it just shows you the level of depravity of the system, you know. Marilyn Buck, another person that was, you know, she was ill. She was in the so-called medical center at Carswell, which I know you know well, Ralph and Betty. And one of the things that the COs used to do was when she was walking with a cane and having difficulty walking, they would stick their feet out and twit her. She only had a few weeks outside before she passed. So we have lost a lot of wonderful warriors. I'm sure I could go on and on. But, you know, it is deliberate. It is done on purpose. It is not a mistake. It is not because they don't know any better. They know what they're doing. They are trying to kill all of our political prisoners one way or another. And if we don't get on the ball and get them out of there very soon, you know, this is what's going to continue to happen. You know, so people, please, you know, write to the prisoners, establish relations with the prisoners, support the prisoners, get to know them. You know, they are some of the most wonderful, wonderful people I have ever met. Del Africa I never actually met, but we corresponded. An amazing, amazing human being, and you heard him speak earlier. So, you know, that's the kind of people we're talking about, and that's the kind of people we need. We need them out here with us. We don't need them, you know, behind these horrible prison walls and suffering forever. You know, we have Rochelle McGee, who's been down since 1963, if you can imagine. I think he's the longest held political prisoner in the world, you know. Ed Poindexter has been in prison for 49 plus years, 50 years actually he's been in prison, an innocent man. And any time he goes, you know, and tries to get anything in court, it was all denied, even though it was clearly a COINTELPRO operation all the way through. And, you know, this is very important, people. We're going to have more political prisoners in the coming times. We can see that we have a few already just from this current movement, and I'm sure we'll have more. So we have to support our prisoners. We cannot leave our comrades behind. If there's one thing I've learned over my years of struggle, never leave a comrade behind. Never leave a comrade behind. If you've got to go back and get them and throw them over your shoulder and run with them, that is what you do. There's no time to be stopping. We have got to overthrow this system. We have to do it. It is, you know, it's a horror on this planet. And what it does to people here and all over the world is just unconscionable and completely unacceptable. And we are here in the belly of the beast. This is our duty and our job to ourselves and to everybody else on this planet. So what's the call? Free them all.
Free them all.
And free yourself and free your minds.
And Sister Ann, please tell them the website.
Oh,
tell them the Jericho website.
JerichoMovement.com. And you can also go to JerichoNY.org. You can find us on Facebook. We have a group, National Jericho Movement. We have a Facebook page, the Jericho Movement. You go to the Jericho Amnesty Movement on Facebook. You can watch this great video I was talking about from Saturday, tremendously moving and riveting discussion by children of political prisoners. And, you know, it's really important that people realize that a political prisoner is not a picture on your wall, you know. A political prisoner is a living, breathing, human being. And they hurt just like everybody else, and they have feelings just like everybody else, you know. So, you know, that's really important. And I think that the children, Mutulu's son, Kamau's daughters, and Makuya's also a Sada's daughter, Mike Africa, you know, Talib Shakur, everybody was wonderful and spoke from the heart. Teresa Schultz had me weeping. So I would definitely encourage people to watch it. It's only an hour and 45 minutes. It's well worth your time. And get involved. Get involved. Do work. You know, you can get in touch with us here, nycjericho@gmail.com. We'd love to have you join us. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that, Ann Lamb. And what can we do? We must tell the Democrats who are in charge of all inner city communities, we don't give a damn about Trump. We're going to vote, or we're going to stay home.
Right. We're going to go to Louisiana. one of the things Sister Ann made clear is that we don't have prisons. We have death camps. And right now we have a sister who's on the front line of a war to see people who are incarcerated in the Angola prison, which is considered one of the worst prisons in the world. She's a founder of the Louisiana United International. Sister Belinda, mic is open.
Sister Betty, I must remind you over and over as we remind ourselves, death camps where people go to be killed. Sister Belinda Parker Brown, your mic is open.
Wow, you are absolutely right, Brother Ralph and Sister Betty. I just want to say you guys are, you know, you are real soldiers, and I thank you so very much for, you know, giving me this opportunity to especially update the listeners on what's happening here in Louisiana in regards to Pastor Reverend Victor. You know, I was listening to the caller before me, and my heart just bleeds for the political prisoners. And the Jericho, I am, you know, 100% in support. You know, I want to, you know, have the opportunity to partner up with the political prisoners with the Jericho movement and be a part of that, because I'm telling you, you know, this is serious and we have to get serious, you know, about it. And I know that you guys are on the front lines, and that you are, you know, taking this matter, you know, on, you know, like bulldog tenacity to fight for, you know, innocent people that are political prisoners. And because of your story with Lynn Stewart, Brother Ralph, you know, I just admire y'all so much, and that I know that you have the passion and the fortitude to fight this fight so that we can win. You know, I just want to say that when we see everything that's happened across the country with, you know, the illuminating people on, you know, taking the streets and you know, with this outrage and this fight, you know, I wish we can just, you know, continue to, you know, stir up the pot and get, you know, this type of snowball effect for the political prisoners. When we have a person like Reverend Victor, you know, an innocent man that was stripped of everything, you know, they took his tragedy, his 7-year-old child, and, you know, made it into a nightmare. And they painted this man to be a monster when he was a predominantly businessman, a contract, a developer in his community, and he was well on his way to bringing a very powerful economic development for poor people in that community. And all because he was, you know, highly, you know, educated, and that he was using his own resources and making connections with the Louisiana Saint players. And, you know, these young men were millionaires, and they partnered up with him because he had the message to bring about this powerful economic development that poor people would be able to strive and come up out of a situation to be very prosperous. So, you know, I'm trying to make this short, but what Louisiana United have done is we have been very successful in declaring that Pastor Victor is an innocent man. We not only would, you know, move to have, you know, some racist, unconstitutional Jim Crow laws, you know, that had been in the Louisiana Constitution for over 100 years, where they would wrongfully convict a person with a non-unanimous jury. So we were successful in getting all of that change. And And not only that, you know, we went to the United States Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, and we filed a lawsuit with the Ramos versus Louisiana. We supported that with all grassroots organizations, and people across the country stood with us to get that heard in the Supreme Court. The decision came back on that hearing, six to three. And of the support in saying that Louisiana can no longer convict the person and put them in prison with a non-unanimous jury, and that was outrageous what they did, if not criminal. Okay, so we won that. Now, Pastor Victor's case was the very first case that. And it was nine others, that ruled in his favor to vacate a conviction that was illegal, if not criminal, what they did. So that was vacated. We got the document. We got the whole certiorari writ that was filed on behalf of him. Then after that, we filed a writ in the court of appeals that was granted the order to vacate his sentence and declared that he was a free man. I'm here to tell you tonight that Pastor Victor is still in Angola. With all the evidence and all the proof that they are holding an innocent man hostage, kidnapped inside of one of the worst prisons, the most bloodiest prison it was known as, Angola. And now we got the COVID-19 spreading like a wildfire. And I'm here to tell you that when you have an innocent man trapped inside of a prison with a deadly virus, and for something to happen to Pastor Victor would be worse than committing genocide. And I'm here to tell you people that we have to ramp this thing up now. We need some big eyes on what's happening here in Louisiana. We need national news, because not only him, we got over 2,000 cases of innocent people that we have vetted, this organization have vetted, that are innocent, and they holding them hostage. Now, this is wrong, because they lying to us about how they're protecting these people, you know, with administrative remedies inside of the prisons in regards to proper medical treatment and who's being tested and who's not and who's sick and who's dying. They're not telling us the truth. So what we're saying now is that we need help. We need national news. We need press conference. We need to call these people out by name, because the judges playing a game. All they doing right now is tag teaming. You know, none of them, they're making up their own rules. You know, Jim Crow is still alive and well.
Belinda Parker Brown, I'd like to interrupt you. We have extended the program again. We have time for everyone else. Would you please give us the way that we can contact you, and what Belinda Parker Brown is trying to tell you, brothers and sisters, is she's continuing the struggle of Ida B. Wells 100 years ago to get a federal law against illegal and legal lynching.
Yes.
And this is a case, a businessman, a successful black businessman is being lynched legally.
Yes.
It is continued for 100 years, and she has taken up that struggle. So tell us
and
how.
And you know, Right. The person before me, he said that what they want to do is that they have determined that they want them to die.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what's going on because, you know, Pastor Victor had all of his children taken away from him. He still don't know where his baby is buried. They put his wife in prison and gave her 40 years. Charged them both with the same crime. After it had been quashed and thrown out and proven that the child died from an asthma attack.
In the hospital. Well,
so,
Sister Belinda, we move on. We've got a lot of speakers.
Yes.
If you give them your website and tell them about your petition. Also, invite them to invite you if they're going to do a webinar. Sister Ann Lamb has been working for years. There are other people on the call who know the case of Mamiya. Mamiya should have been out ago. So you're right about the pattern in America. But as long as we have these corrupt politicians, such as Trish James, Brother Jaleel should have been out, and the white judge was willing to let him go, and Trish James decides she's going to let him stay.
Democratic Party in Brooklyn, state of New York, Cuomo says he had nothing to do with it. It's a lie. We must stop voting for these clowns.
We should recall them when they don't do what we want them to do.
And a final reminder, we're not afraid of Trump. If they don't do something quickly on our political prisoners, we're going to suggest that people stay home. We can take another 4 years of Trump rather than another 4 years of this Democratic Party lying.
And don't forget, Biden is the one who was the main orchestrator of militarization of the police. Sister Belinda, give them your contact information. If you have an event coming up, either online or elsewhere, please let them know. And she also needs your solidarity in forwarding her links to Facebook or your listserv. Go ahead, Sister Belinda.
Yes, thank you, Sister Betty, Brother Raph. It's time for us to act. And I want you to know that we're challenging our governor now, and we're saying that we're going to win this fight with freedom for all of these people that have been wrongfully incarcerated, and we can't do it without, you know, like Brother Raph said, we got to do something drastic. We got to do something. We got to expose the corrupt Democratic Party that is the gatekeepers for this type of crimes that are being committed, crimes against these people, you know, kidnapping, you know, holding people hostage, you know, we know for a fact that this is what's going on here in Louisiana. So please go to my website. Please go to my website at www.launitedi.org, or you can call me at 985-503-0626. Thank you, Sister Betty and Brother Raph.
Thank you again. And with that said, we must go to 4295.
Brother Paul, your mic is open, and Sister Belinda, you keep us abreast of everything that's happening. We're behind you 100%. Brother Paul, your mic is open. And we want you to know, people, we have extended the time because there are a number of people who want to get in and talk in terms of for the Delbert Africa and also give us an update on all the craziness and horrific stories that have been developing in this country this past week. Thank you, Brother Paul, for being on the line. Your mic is open.
Thank you for having me, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph. It's great to talk to you again and everybody in the audience. And, this is an old story. I'm going to be talking about Leonard Peltier. June 26th will be close to the 45th, I think it's the 44th anniversary of the, or 45th of the incident of Oglala. For those who aren't aware of who Leonard Peltier is, he's a Native American activist that's falsely convicted of killing two FBI agents. There was a shootout on Pine Ridge Reservation in which like about 50 people were involved, and any one of those 50 people could have killed the officers. Of course, it's a more involved story than that. You can go to the Leonard Peltier website. There's numerous ones that will give you the story. But I want to say, you know, we're talking about police occupying neighborhoods. Well, in Indian reservations, that's federal territory. So their police, besides the local Indian police, is the FBI. The FBI is their main police force on the Indian reservations. When there's a murder or anything, you know, it's federal jurisdiction. And so they armed a death squad in the 1970s that killed like 64 people, shot and injured and blew up or beat up or whatever, many, many more. So a Native American is more likely to be killed by the police even than a black person. I'm not saying it's a race to, you know, it's all horrible, everything, but we have to be aware of this. So the Bronx Greens are talking about doing an event on Friday, June 26th, to commemorate Leonard Peltier. He's still in prison. He's about 74 years old. He's sick. He can barely walk. They give him the jobs where he's got to stand up. Now, one recent development, which is good, is two Congress people have written to Trump asking that Trump release Leonard because of the COVID. You know, he's old. He's not a threat to society. He never really was. And these two Congress people are Representative Deb Haaland. She's a Democrat from New Mexico. Look, I'm not supporting the Democratic Party. I'm in the Bronx Greens. But, you know, we got to give credit where credit is due. Now, I don't know where she stands on anything else. And the other one is Representative Raul M. Grijalva, also a Democrat of Arizona, and I give the same caveat. I'm a Bronx Greens. I don't support the Democrat. But these two Congress people did write letters, public letters to Trump, asking that Leonard Peltier be freed. I mean, should I go into the story of what happened at Pine Ridge in the 1970s? Or
thank you so much for that. We can't tell the story too many times because the indigenous people here in America are gone. And we must also support those who support us, those Congress people, those politicians who support our political prisoners must be supported. So thank you so much for that. And it brings me to tears when I think of what happened to the indigenous people in America. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't something
They didn't disappear. They're still here.
They are here, but not in the
numbers.
Not only
are they here, their numbers are increasing. But they're going through the same hell that everybody else is going through, plus more.
Exactly. That was a mistake to say they are disappearing. They are fighting the attempt to disappear.
They are fighting tooth and nail.
Okie doke. Well, thank you for that. And we must move on.
All right. Paul, do you want to give us that information about the event one more time, please, before we go on?
Well, we haven't finalized the details. Just keep Friday, June 26th, open. We're probably going to go to Union Square and do a vigil. The question is what time, because there's going to be also some kind of teach-in on Leonard Peltier, and I got to coordinate the times. So when I go on the show next week, I'll give the final information. Just keep Friday, June 26th, open, and I'll give you the details of exactly what we're going to do. We're probably going to go to Union Square about 4 o'clock or maybe 8, 7 o'clock. We're still making our decision on that.
Hey, thanks again for keeping us in touch with that movement.
And a shout out to Ann Lamb. Ann, I did just send you an email on this.
Yes, Jericho carries all of the information on Leonard Peltier. Thanks again, Sister Betty.
All right, we're going to keep it in the loop of activists who are on the call. We try to give them priority so that they can get their message to you. Brother Gil Obler, your mic is open. Thank you for returning.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Yeah, I just, you know, I'm a Green too, but I'm also working with the African People's Socialist Party and the Uyghur Solidarity Movement underneath that leadership, as well as the Freedom Mia Coalition. And what unites all those struggles is I want to address sort of the question of anti-racism and going beyond anti-racism to anti-colonialism, because that's one of the key insights that I got from Amalia Shetela, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party, that racism, anti-racism is still white-centered. It's still about what white people think. And in the end, you know, colonized communities, you know, they just need not to be killed. They just need their resources and their labor not to be stolen. And they need to not be occupied by the various occupation armies, whether it's AFRICOM or the police or the military, you know, depending on the colonial situation. And there's also a real clarity in anti-colonialism. You know, the struggle of indigenous people in this country, the struggle of indigenous people to throw out the colonizers in Africa, the struggle of the Vietnamese, et cetera, is clear. When you talk about anti-racism, you know, are you talking about a bill that Mario Cuomo delivered, or are you talking about real community control of the police, such as what happened in Camden, New Jersey? Very different things. And, you know, if you want to answer the question, anti-racism brought us Obama. But under Obama, there was no change in real wages. There was no change in the redlining, the predatory behavior of Wall Street and the banks. There was no change in the mass incarceration, which was really just there's a whole thing about the new Jim Crow. But the truth is, from 1870, 1880s, convict leasing was going on. I mean, the slavery continued unabated, in different forms within the mass incarceration system and the criminal injustice system. So, you know, to really understand why under Obama, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan continued to be colonized, Palestine continued to be colonized, so Libya and Syria were destroyed, and then Yemen. you can't understand it if you just look at racism. But if you look at colonialism, it becomes very clear. So that's all I wanted to say.
Colonialism certainly clarifies the issue as how we got to racism. And racism is a state of mind that colonialism brought to the people to keep colonialism. But that's a very important discussion to be had. But next up, we have...
Before we go to Brother Higgins, Henry Higgins, I want to ask Gil to please give the name of the organization again.
Yeah, that's Uhura Solidarity Movement, which is uhurasolidarity.org is the website. You can find out more about it. Uhura Solidarity is the white allies, the white support for reparations and for black the black working class leadership. And then the African organization is the African People's Socialist Party, and that's APSPUhuru.org, the African People's Socialist Party.
And we are always available, because the program is... What is the program, Betty? Yeah, the program is recorded, and you can always look up the program. If there's any information that you would like to know, you can get to that information through this program, everything you've heard.
I want to make it clear that when things were really, really rough for us, and Sister Lynn was clearly being murdered in prison, as Sister Ann Lamb makes clear, that's what they do. You're very dangerous if you think. And when you think, you know what's wrong. And when you think you know something that's wrong and you lift up your fist against it, the whole imperialist power lands on you. And so when we were really, really desperate to get Sister Lynn out, one of the organizations, Chairman Yeshiteli, Omali Yeshitela, called Ralph and supported Sister Lynn. It may be the African People's Socialist Party, but they were 100% behind Lynn. Without further ado, I want to go to someone who's extremely loyal to Mamiya and all political prisoners and a lovely person to know. Get a lot of people in the movement, and they work hard, but, you know, sometimes they're not nice people. They get on your nerves. But this brother, he is one of the nicest, sweetest people I've ever met. Brother Henry Higgins, your mic is open.
You're gonna make me blush, Sister Betty. Thank you so much for the kind words. I want to just say that Dilbert Africa Presente, he was a good brother and should have never been arrested along with the Move 9. And it's an indication of how this society works against progressive forces to silence them and to derail their efforts to create a humane and progressive society. I just want to briefly touch on a piece of work done by Vince Copeland some years ago from Workers' World Party. He published a work entitled Expanding Empire, and he talks about the fact that United States domestic and foreign policies are two sides of the same coin. And he begins, well, not begins, but here we jump into part of his explanation in the following manner. He says the first real foreign war of the United States was the Spanish-American War, and it took place almost simultaneously with the first real expansion in the U.S. foreign investment. And it is the first secret of understanding that war as it is understanding all subsequent U.S. wars. It was precisely in the 1890s that investment abroad, that is, the export of U.S. capital, took place on substantial scale. And in 1897, just before the Spanish-American War, there was still only $700 million U.S. dollars invested abroad. By 1914, the foreign holdings had leaped to $3.5 billion, five times as much. Without the war, this could have not happened. The war with Spain was motivated by the desire to exploit Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the rest of Latin America and the Philippines, and to get complete control of the Caribbean so as to facilitate the U.S. control of the contemplated Panama Canal and open up easier access to business expansion in the Far East. It was a question of economic expansion and pretty much understood and openly explained as such at the time. The expansion into foreign countries resulted from a new stage in the expansion of business, the export of capital. Business had become exporting ordinary commodities of trade for centuries. The export of capital was something new, especially for the United States, and it couldn't be done without foreign wars. The reason for this isn't so very complicated. The export of capital goods, that is, machinery, mining equipment, railroad engines, earth-moving tools, etc., is intended not to make just a quick small profit, but a constantly repeating profit that can go on forever if the exploiter can hold on to his investment. And so, in effect, capitalism is like a disease. It latches on to peoples and properties for the sake of making a profit for those who are doing the aggressive behavior. And I just want to end it there.
Well, thank you so much for that, Henry Higgins. My slow mind couldn't bring up the word archived. That means that you can dial up every program that you have heard here. It's archived by date, and you can hear get this information over and over again. Next up is 3933.
Sister Gwen, your mic is open, and we want to tell people, hang in there. We've extended the time. Got a wonderful presentation that we're anticipating from Brother Joel and Sister Dolores. But before we move on from Brother Henry Higgins, I hope you can connect the dots between what Brother Henry said, what Brother Joel said, I'm sorry, what Brother Paul said, and what Gil said. We're talking about a system of rape, economic rape here, and it connects the dots. But many of you don't know because you don't fight on that level. for those of you who have a job and you're doing your job right and you make a decision which is anti the establishment, like you're a black or white teacher and you defend the student that is innocent being charged by a cop or anything in your classroom, or you insist on teaching about political prisoners, or you're a fifth grade social studies teacher and you encourage students to send cards with the permission of their parents to Mayor Abdul-Jamal, and the next thing you know, you're fired. That's colonialism. That's what happened to Marilyn Zuniga. That's the celebrity case. But it happens all the time to black and brown teachers who insist on being successful with their students. Their supervisors find a way to write them up and get them out of the system. So that right now, ethnic cleansing is going on in our school system. The teachers who are black and brown are down 50% in our system. They are weeding and washing them out. It is a deliberate agenda, just like the agenda to take our public schools is a deliberate agenda. A democracy cannot exist without a public education system.
Right.
Country controlled by a corporation cannot afford a democratic school system. So even if you can't do what Mamiya did, if you can't do what Delva did, you can go in and run for the PTA.
And it was a Democratic administration that got rid of the basics. The basics of life is education. And we complain over and over again, the school-to-prison pipeline, well, you couldn't do that with Marilyn Zuniga. Elementary school, the key to education, and the Democrats had nothing better to do but to shut her down. Thanks again. Archive.
We're introducing you, and I had to say that about education, because I don't know too many people who fought so hard like you against the democratic corrupt system to have our schools and our communities. Sister Gwen, your mic is open. Sister Dolores, hang in there.
Hi, everybody. Thank you, Betty. That was really informative. I want to thank Belinda and Ann Lamb for just the incredible job you do. It's really heartfelt, and it's a tremendous amount of work, and you really are wonderful people to go in and do the things you're doing. So thank you. I want to talk about a videotape that Betty sent me, and this was a videotape of a pregnant woman or a woman coming home from a convenience store in a dark parking lot in front of her building on May the 14th. And in 45 seconds, this woman was shot to death by a policeman. She was walking to her building. A policeman came upon her, and he said, I don't even know whether he said something about warrants, but that's what he says he was there for. But he was by himself. And she said, "Stop harassing me." And I also thought I heard him say something about the curfew. Although I don't think there was a curfew at that time. But anyway, she said, "Stop harassing me." And he said, I'm going to arrest you. And he grabbed for her, and she pulled away, and he tasered her. He tasered her. And as she was on the ground, she reached up. She didn't get anywhere near him, but he took his gun out, and he shot her 5 times. Before he shot her, she said to him, "I'm pregnant." Just for the men in the audience, women who are being attacked, women who know they're going to be raped, will do anything to stop that. And often we'll say we are pregnant, we'll say we have to go to the bathroom, we'll say anything to stop it. And this, nobody knew this woman's name, and so when I saw the tape, we had to find her name, and her name was Pamela Shante Turner. And she is from outside of Austin, Texas, in a town called Bayview. I think for everybody in the audience, it's really important to remember that this woman's name has really been shoved under the rug, although it was covered by CNN News. And what was very interesting about the coverage is at the beginning of the day, early in the morning, the way they wrote it up was pretty much the way I just told you. But by the end of the day, they said that she had outstanding warrants.
So that's
started out with warrants, then it was outstanding warrants, and then they said that she screamed at him, that he was harassing her. And basically what they were doing is what they do to most rape victims. They were turning the tables back on her, making this attack look like she had provoked it. To me, I believe probably the officer was shaking her down for sex. She probably had some traffic tickets that she couldn't pay. She was poor. And I think they knew each other. And it's very similar to the George Floyd case, because those two men, officer Chauvin and Floyd, worked at the same bar for a number of years. They were both bouncers. There were only 28 people that worked there, so I find it hard to believe that they didn't know each other. So I wanted to put this out there, because if you're going to go to a demonstration, I'd like you, especially women, to remember Pamela Shante Turner. I think it's really important that we bring up her murder and we show this murder, and that I actually have two friends that I've been talking to about possibly even going to Texas to try to find out more from the family, because it's an awful thing that happened. And I know it's happening everywhere to everyone, but this was, it seemed like it was even more blatant than Floyd. They're all bad. But I wanted to put that out there. And then I just wanted to also say that I think that we need to really look at things in a holistic way, like the whole picture of what's going on here. I think Betty sent me another interesting tape, and it was very interesting because there's a woman that was talking about FEMA and how powerful they are and how the disease is really being brought here to possibly take us to a new world order, and the disease is, of course, being used to thin out the population. But whenever we think of things, I think we have to look at the larger picture. Last night, every single telephone carrier in the United States went down, every single one. And I find that to be something bizarre, because that is a huge story, and it didn't make the TV. It didn't make the news. I had to go to my own telephone store last night when I thought my phone was broken. And Joel and I were discussing it today, and it just seems like all of these things are coming up as exercises for what else is going to be in store for us. And I think it's really important that we remember that when we're fighting with each other over Democrats or Republicans, and then we do our race wars, that what we're really doing is we're giving that 1% of the 1% exactly what they want: turbulence. They don't want us acting together. They want us to be separated. It's a lot easier to conquer us when we're separated and to ultimately get domination over the world. I don't even know why they want it, but that's what they want. So we are really in a dangerous time right now. You all know that. But I still, you know, I also heard today that the Indian nation has suffered the largest losses of anyone in the United States to COVID. And I also heard that calculating a bomb of that it is now totally getting rampant in the prisons, which most of you already know. So it seems like this submarine of death, you know, keeps cruising on to just calculated populations. I went to my parents this last week, and very few people were wearing masks in Cape May, and very few people thought they were going to get this disease. And it is a very strange thing that it seems to just attack certain people. And I think we need to look into that. So I'm going to leave you with that little bit of information tonight. And I want to thank every single person who spoke tonight, because you are all hero warriors and just doing magnificent work. But in case nobody thanked you, I'm thanking you today. Good night.
Thank you so much for that, Gwen Goodwin, who has done such great work. But without further ado, I would say do not go to Austin, Texas. Try to do as much work as you can by phone and by computer. It is not a nice place. I did cases down in Austin, Texas, and I was told by a very informative person, stay in the city limits. You take one step outside, and you won't even make page 10 of the newspaper. And so be careful, Gwen. Next up.
Okay. I want to thank Gwen, because I consider her a very courageous person, and I consider her a very strong person, because I can't stand dealing with these corrupt politicians 2 seconds without go for their throat. and she really is always gracious. I hate to use this archaic term, but she's always a lady. She's always professional, and she's brilliant with them. She ties them up in knots. Without further ado, I want to go to somebody else who's like that. In the old days, we would have said she's a perfect lady, but boy, is she tough as nails. Sister Dolores, her history in the movement is just phenomenal. I don't think there's anyone she didn't support, and we will never forget that she was always our eyes and ears in the movement for Sister Lynn. The minute some activity showed up that she thought we should go to support Lynn, she would call us and let us know. Sister Dolores, your mic is open, and don't you dare go anywhere.
I'm still here. Thanks to everybody. Thank you for everybody. I don't have much to say about the coronavirus right now, except to comment on the fact that this evil president we have has chosen Tulsa, Oklahoma, as the place to resume his campaigning. Meanwhile, Tulsa, like most other cities, has been impacted by the virus. And Trump will be attracting hundreds of people to the city during the pandemic. And I understand that Oklahoma had a very large turnout for Trump during the last election. So that's interesting as well. Another thing about Tulsa, when Bloomberg was running for president, he took out a full-page letter to the Tulsa residents in the Amsterdam News for several weeks, saying that he was going to Tulsa to provide necessary assistance. Okay, this is part of his campaigning. And about the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, about 10 years ago, I met Dr. Olivia Hooker. She's one of the survivors of the Tulsa race massacre in Greenwood, known as Black Wall Street. She came to Brooklyn, invited by D12. She was only 6 years old when the massacre happened. And when she came and spoke to us, she had recalled the trauma that she and her family experienced, along with the rest of the black residents, so vividly that, you know, it was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking. And she was so nice to answer every question that we had, and so pleasant. And, you know, she received her PhD in psychology from the University of Rochester, New York, and then she became a lecturer here at Fordham University, and always was a civil rights activist. And the other thing about this Tulsa case, Charles Ogletree, a civil rights attorney and Harvard law professor, along with Johnny Conklin, they filed a lawsuit in 2003 against Tulsa, the city, and against the state of Oklahoma for reparations for somewhere between 100 and 150 survivors that were still remaining. Dr. Hooker, at that time, during the lawsuit, was 93 years old. To make a long story short, justice was both delayed and denied because the U.S. Supreme Court, 2 years later, in 2005, dismissed the case. So, anyway, Dr. Hooker, she died in November of 2018. She lived to be 103 years old, so she was the last known survivor of the Tulsa, Oklahoma-based massacre, which she referred to as this that so-called riot as a catastrophe, which reminds you what the Palestinians say about what happened to them by the Israelis. And so, you know, I just want to let folks to know that there was a DVD that came out in 2008, and it was called Before They Die, and it was about the stories of the survivors who were all up in age and dying one after another. So Dr. Olivia Hooker, presente, you know, I just wanted to add that a little bit about Tulsa and this evil president going there, you know, to resume his campaign during the pandemic.
Thank you so much, Dolores. And everyone should know that Tulsa was known as the Black Wall Street. It was during the Depression when the people in Tulsa had learned what the people in New York, some of the people in New York had, to keep the money in the community. And while the rest of the country was in this economic problem, the black people of Tulsa did not have the problem, and they were murdered. There was a riot by the police and the white establishment, and the army came in to finish them off. So when you have success, lift yourself up by your bootstraps. You are always in peril of being destroyed physically by the American government and colonialism, if you will, racism, if you have another name for it. But Tulsa was a terrible story, and it is related to the question of Mr. Victor, successful businessmen and lynching, black businessmen and lynching in America. The beat goes on. Sister Betty.
Okay, before we go to Brother Joel, who's going to take us out, we noticed we've got a number here that we don't often see. We're going to give you an opportunity if you want to. The last four digits are 4711. 4711. 4711, your mic is open if you want to make a comment.
No, thank you.
All right, sweetheart. Welcome to the program. The second number is the last four digits are 7390. 7390. You want to make a few comments before we go to our last speaker of the evening? Welcome to Ralph Pointer, What's Happening. First three
yes,
digits
my name
are
is Stephen Harris. I'm here.
Yes. Mr. Harris, did you want to make a comment? Again.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Please begin. Your mic is open.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to state that, you know, I just coming out of the state of Mississippi, I stand in solidarity with LUI, Louisiana United International, and solidarity with many other organizations that are standing on the platform to achieve one common goal. That is to eradicate racism, because racism is rooted in every form of government right here in our country on every level, and it's even global in terms of speaking about genocide. And I also want to say that you know that I'm campaigning for a brother by the name of Victor, who is currently incarcerated in the state of Louisiana, and he, you know, he's fighting an uphill battle, and even after the highest court in the land have gave a verdict for his case to be vacated and remanded. But the state of Louisiana have still insisted on holding him against his will, and he's fighting an uphill battle, and I stand in solidarity with everybody that's fighting, campaigning for him, as well as thousands of others. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, his name again. Brother Harris, thank you, and you call in anytime. You have any story you want to get out, especially from Mississippi, you don't forget this number. And we thank Sister Belinda for her leadership and encouraging people such as you to be in unison to fight against the death camps in this country. Thank you for calling in. We appreciate you.
Yes, ma'am.
Brother Joel, without further ado, your mic is open.
Yes, I'd like to start off by referring to an article that was in the New York Times on June 10th. That was, I believe, the previous Monday, June 10th, 2020.
Go ahead.
The article begins, a white National Guard commander called the standoff in Lafayette Square the Alamo. That's when a number of large number of protesters gathered across the street from the White House, and Trump, in a panic, had himself taken to a six-story below the ground level bunker because protesters were across the street. He chose the paranoid manner in which he acts, but there's much more to the article than that. Because the White House, a white National Guard commander called the standoff in Lafayette Square the Alamo, implying that the White House was under siege. Black members of the D.C. Guard objected to turning on their neighbors. Now, Army leaders told pilots to, quote, flood the box with everything we have, as two helicopters buzzed protesters in the streets. Now, that sounds like
we're losing you.
Order to fire on the protesters from the helicopters. And these military helicopters, I heard, could fill a football field with a bullet in every square inch of that field within 20 seconds. So that these are heavily armed helicopters that are not just observing. And so Army leaders told pilots to fill the box with everything we have. Now, we know that that didn't happen because there would have been a major massacre if that order was carried out. But that sentence before says that black members of the D.C. Guard objected to turning on their neighbors. So it sounds like a part of the Army didn't carry out an order that would have led to a total massacre. And probably the reaction to that is totally, well, it's impossible to gauge, because that would have set the entire country and even the world on fire if that had happened. Now, this is a New York Times article, and I don't see any other way of interpreting it. Maybe somebody else could show me. But also, it was not mentioned in that way in any other medium that I'm aware of, and that whole situation was glossed over and not really mentioned. But it shows the crisis that we're in now and the unpredictably vicious nature of the ruling class, which, although to us it looks like sometimes they look formidable, they are very scared and panicky to be even thinking of such things. And it also shows how for the people in the military, who know that many of whom know what this system is using them for and are reluctant to carry out these orders, such as the National Guard unit there, we have to keep in mind that as revolutionaries, one of the key things that we have to be raising is the question of a mutiny by the military, because this system is all based on us being held at gunpoint by the police and the military. Historically, the military forces, especially the rank-and-file soldiers, have very often turned their guns around another way against the people that want to keep everybody else at gunpoint and after everybody else. The police, historically, in almost any situation, have always been the last and the fewest to ever come over to revolutionary sympathies or even mutiny against the bloodthirsty actions of the cornered ruling class. So this is a very major development, and it may show that the struggle is much further advanced than many of us can imagine after years of watching uphill struggles, and it also shows what happens if we miss the opportunity, and if there is no revolution, it shows how the ruling class is going to get more and more bloody, vicious, fascistic, and that basically we have to take out the ruling class and its capitalist system, or they're going to take us out. That's what the justice decision is.
Thank you so much for that, Joel. That was a very important statement and a very important report. We're going to start off with that next week because we could not hear you. And so You know, it's very important. And remember that this was hidden from the people. And so we'd like to hear that again next week, but try to improve your situation where we can get it clearer.
Okay, we're opening up
Mike. July 10th of the New York Times, in case anyone wants to look it up. Aggressive tactics by National Guard ordered to appease Trump wounded the military too.
All right, thank you. That was in the New York Times. Joel was saying that was in the New York Times. Listen, folks, we've got your mics open. Before we shut off, if anybody wants to give the last words, anybody want to, all your mics are open if you wanted to give a few more words.
Okay. With that said, my brothers and sisters, we have had another excellent conversation, and more important, we have had great information. Listen in again next week. And we will bring more information because we are about education and freeing all of our political prisoners. Thank you. Thank you. Love you all. And good night.
I wish.